عظم قدر جاه محمد وأنا له فضل عليه عظيما وفي محكم التنزيل قال لخلقه صلوا عليه صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما.
Hello and welcome to the Religion Matters podcast, the podcast that explores how centuries-old religious traditions meet new challenges in the 21st century. I'm your host, Amin Al-Asri, and this is the second part of our podcast about Sufism. If you haven't yet, please check out the first part that was hosted by my classmate Iris Lee, where she discussed Sufi music and its spread across the globe. In today's episode, we'll talk about the spiritual experience of Sufis with Mr. Khalid Al-Abdi. We'll discuss the ins and outs of what it is like being a Sufi, and the Sufi journey towards non-dual self-realization. Our guest today is Mr. Khalid Al-Abdi, a member of the International Association Sufi Alawiya Order. His greatest passion lies in translating and speaking on issues of culture, faith, and peace. Mr. Khalid has translated many books, including Sufism, The Heart of Islam, which was originally written in French by Sheikh Khalid bin Tunis, the current spiritual leader of the Sufi order, Tariqa Al-Alawiyya Al-Darqawiyya Al-Shadiliya. Hi, Mr. Khalid. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, and thank you.
Before we delve into our topic, growing up in Morocco and interacting with Sufis throughout my upbringing, I know that it is nearly impossible to give a brief description of Sufism in all of its forms without essentializing major aspects. So for the purposes of a simple definition, we could say that the major theme of Sufism that is nearly universally agreed upon is the idea of love, that everything is for love and everything is through love. And this point is expressed extensively throughout Sufi philosophy, literature, and art. However, I'm curious about how you personally define Sufism based on your own experience.
Sufism is the heart of Islam. And from my own point of view, the way I experience this is I go to the inner side of things. That is what I see when dealing with human beings, with myself, with my family, with everything around me. So instead of just looking at the inner side of things, I try to reach the inside, because that is what I see myself in.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, Sufism seeks to explore the practice of self-knowledge. And knowing oneself means apprehending a lived experience of one's being. I find your answer intriguing because it carries two fundamental notions of Sufism, which are the ideas of self and experience. And I would love to know more about your own experience with the self as a Sufi, or as we say in Arabic, faqir. What drew you towards Sufism and made you want to become a faqir?
Faqir means poor. Mm-hmm. What each person in the tariq, in the spiritual path of God, seeks to be as poor as possible in the eyes of God. Ya ayyuhal ladina amanu antumul fuqara. Wallahu wal ghani. O ye who believe, you are the poor in the eyes of God. And God is the, like I said, the rich, because you always show need for divine benevolence. You don't depend on yourself in some sort to say that okay, I have self sufficiency, for example. So by trying to look at this aspect, I told myself, you know, there must be something else. I wanted to investigate, let's say, a part of myself that I wasn't able to find in regular, you know, regular practice of traditional Islam.
So would you say that what distinguishes a person as a Sufi is this journey you mentioned of investigating oneself? In other words, what determines if someone is a Sufi or not?
Nobody can determine whether you're a Sufi or not except your teacher. Okay? When you want to join, and I'm going to use the word order, and I understand that the word order is, you know, gives the idea that, you know what I mean, is just you're belonging to a group of people, and usually that sparks some sort of like a caution or on the part of the person who's good to speak. Nobody can come and tell you you're not a good Sufi or you're not a good Muslim because it's something in it. Nobody sees that on you. Now, a lot of people are muhibbin. They're lovers. They come and they perform dhikr with people. They want to get close to that atmosphere, to that divine atmosphere, be it in the zawiya, be it in the company of the sheikh, be it in the company of the fuqara, okay? But it all depends on the intention. If your intention is to get to be acquainted as much as you can or as much as you want with the discipline, with the Sufism, then that is, in my eyes, that is enough. But nobody can tell you you are a Sufi or you're not a Sufi.
So from what I understand, it all depends on the relationship you're trying to establish between yourself and God.
Yes.
Correct.
I'll give you an anecdote over here. I don't know whether it was by Sheikh Sidi Sheikh Al-Alawi or by Sheikh Sidi Al-Hajj Adda. He was once with his fuqara on the street, and a drunkard passed by. And he looked at him and said, "Sidi Sheikh, can you give me 2 dirhams to complete my drunkenness?" You know, and the sheikh gave him the 2 dirhams. Now, for a sheikh to give a drunkard 2 dirhams to do that, that sparked some sort of, hey, what's going on? Why is the sheikh doing that? As far as the disciples are concerned. Then he said, he asked me for 2 dirhams to complete his drunkenness, to swim in his drunkenness, physical drunkenness. I gave him the 2 dirhams to swim in my own drunkenness, in my, you know, in the divine drunkenness. Because I didn't see a drunkard. I saw a person. So that's how, you know, Sufis look. I mean, real Sufis look at things.
The point you just brought up reminds me of a quote of Shams Tabrizi that I ran into in his book, Rumi's Son, The Teachings of Shams of Tabriz, in which he says, quote, "Don't judge the way other people connect to God, to each their own way and their own prayer. God does not take us at our word. He looks deep into our hearts. It's not the ceremonies or rituals that make a difference, but whether our hearts are sufficiently pure or not."
Honesty, again, honesty and love between you and the Creator. Remains honesty between you and the Creator, love between you and the Creator. Now, of course, it is going to show on you once you are in society. If you are like a good Sufi, well-learned, and have a good knowledge of the presence, the continuous holy presence of God, then you're not going to be dishonored. You're not going to do evil. You're not going to commit, I don't dare say sins, but you're going to try as much as you can to avoid sins. Because what you do is you always feel, or you have this feeling that you are in the presence of God, that you are being watched. There are some people who feel that being that they are being watched, and because of that, they fear the presence of God. There are others who feel that they're being watched and respect the presence of God. Mm-hmm. Others who have reached a much higher state or condition do that because they love God.
The next point I want to discuss with you is Sufism in more of a global context. I know that each Sufi order or tariqa, which is usually named after its founder, espouses its own doctrine and tradition, whether that's music, social convention, or political culture, all of which underscore the nuances and diversity that are like hallmarks of Islamic civilization. However, I'm just wondering how are all these Sufi orders or turuq striving for the same unity in Sufism?
Tariqa is a path. It leads you to a holy destination. And if anyone tells you that that holy destination is the end of it, that is not the mastery. Mastery dictates that whatever destination you reach, you need to realize that it is a departure. Each tariqa has the very same objective or goal, which is to get the disciples, to get the followers as close to God or as possible. Each has his own discipline of doing that. On the image of the prophets, alayhim salam, each prophet came with the same goal, but they presented their goal differently, in different languages, in different conditions, because they were talking to different people and in different times. The same thing with the brotherhoods. The master talks to people according to the way they understand. And it is the same, as I said, the same for all brotherhoods. That is the objective. The difference is how the masters or the teachers deal with that. And that depends on the conditions of the country. That depends on the economic also and social condition of, you know, the place where they live. For example, with Sheikh Al-Alawi and people, the shuyukh before him, they were under the occupation, the French occupation. So they had to deal with that. Shuyukh who came after him, Sid al-Hajj Udda and Sid al-Hajj al-Mahdi, they were also under the French occupation. Sid al-Hajj Mahdi, for example, was incarcerated, because of the way he wanted to deal with that and to get Algeria out of the to get its independence. Sidi Sheikh Al-Alawi, for example, wanted to modernize the thinking that people had about tasawwuf. For a lot of people, tasawwuf was this enclosure of zawiya in a corner. Zawiya in Arabic means corner. So you are cornered in a place, and you have your litanies, you have your jalabas, and you go and then you do your word and things like that. You have nothing outside that. So in other words, you don't speak a second language or a third language. You don't know how to deal with other people. When people come to you and ask you about Islam, you don't know what to say. So, if you are a good disciple, or if you are a good master, you prepare your disciples to speak for tariqa, or to speak for Sufism, or to speak for you. Because after all, if you're a master, you're a messenger. And if you're a messenger, you have a message. And if you have a message, then you need people to help you with that. Mm-hmm. And if you have people to help you with that, you need methodology. You cannot do that without actually teaching your disciples how, you know, to not teach, but how to spread the message.
Since we are talking about Sufi orders or Turuq, one of the Turuqs I would like to ask you about is Tariq al-Alawiyah, which you are a member of. I know that like the basic doctrine of Tariq al-Alawiyah is reaching purification of heart through a saintly life. But I'm also wondering what makes Tariq al-Alawiyah different from other Sufi orders or Turuq.
Tariq al-Alawiyah is the first Tariqah in the 20th century that wanted to make this connection between Eastern education and Western education. So the learning of another language was introduced. The learning of social events outside Algeria was introduced. Learning, and a lot of disciples and Sufi teachers were sent to Europe. The first mosque, for example, that was established through Tariq al-Alawiyah, that was set by was set in Paris. That was the first mosque in Europe that was, you know, established or set by Tariq al-Alawiyah. So that's what Tariq al-Alawiyah did, is actually to relate this enclosure of Sufism inside the country and bring it to Europe.
And Tariq al-Alawiyah, a significant Sufi practice that enables Sufis to keep the presence of Allah before them, is dhikr, which could be translated to remembrance, and sama', which means listening. I'm just wondering how are these two connected to each other and how are they performed?
Do you know Kulthum?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course. Now she has she has a song that goes in Arabic, Sami'atu Sultan Hatifan Fi Sahar. Nada min al ghaib. Okay. What she's saying, I'll translate that. She says, I heard a sound or a deep sound and a dawn. Nada. So the focus over here is on your ear, on your listening capacity, on how you relate to the deeper side of yourself first, not by talking, but by sama. When you hear things first, you feel their presence inside you. Then you repeat. Samia wa dhakara. And then it turns into a cycle. That remembrance, as long as you get keen on it, and as long as you become acquainted with it, then you start yourself making that sama'. You are listening. You start listening to yourself. The discipline of sama' is, you know, people come in and sitting together, and then there is a musammi', one who performs the sama', and it has, you know, as I said, tea is passed on. It's not only like people gather and then one is singing or one is chanting poems or no. It's a whole discipline. You have to sit a certain way. You have to follow the cadence of the words said, the way the poem is said. And of course, you follow, you listen, you hear, and you follow. Because you do that, you get thirsty. And when you get thirsty, there are people who come and they give you cups of tea. And in those cups of tea, they contain only a certain amount. And there is only a certain amount of sugar in it. Then they pass on water. It reminds me of the Japanese tradition when they'd want to drink, tea, and now they sit down, they turn it around, and they sit down in a way so it becomes, how can I say, a whole display, a whole array of steps you do, of actions you do. There is a very deep correlation between dhikr and sama', especially when you perform dhikr with a certain tone.
Mm-hmm. Hearing you explain all these details that are involved within sama' and dhikr is just fascinating to me, because I've always thought of them as two entities that could be performed without any prior planning. And again, the goal of this sama' and dhikr is to reach a spiritual connection with God. But how can a Sufi tell that they have reached this connection, or at least they are on the right path to do so?
That is a very tricky question. One thing is common, okay? Sidna Sheikh, when he talks about this, he said, first, there's the person who performs that dhikr, and then there is another person in front of him who does the very same thing. At that level, there is you and I, each different from the other. Then we move to a second stage where we perform the same dhikr, at which station we say, you are I and I am you, because we are performing the same thing. Mm-hmm. There is another level. The third level is when we go so into it that there is neither you nor I.
Mm-hmm.
There is only one voice. One voice. And that's it. There is that self-awareness that whether you are with people or not, you feel oneness. And again, it's personal experience. Anyone who tells you this is how I feel, this is what you should feel, no. It's like your love for your wife. You can't mm-hmm. describe it. Mm-hmm. Or your life for your teacher. You can't describe it. It is seen on you.
So would you say Al-Hadra is a way to reach that voice or oneness you just mentioned? For people who are listening to us, Al-Hadra, or Imara in Arabic, is a form of Sufi celebration of God through the recitation of religious poems. And each Sufi order has its unique set of songs of remembrance or dhikr that are performed during Al-Hadra. So if you could tell us a little bit more about Al-Hadra and how it helps in reaching that oneness.
This is a text from the book, Sheikh Sidi Khaled, Sufism, the Heart of Islam. Mm-hmm. This is how a writer called Emil Dirmingham describes that. Says, standing, the eyes closed, holding tight to each other, the right hand in the left hand of the next person, the fingers intertwined. The brothers build a close circle in whose center a qutb, vertex, marks the cadence, claps his hands, turns around, watches every single person and all at the same time, switches the place of this or that one so that the whole group stays balanced, stops when disorder threatens or when exhaustion overtakes. In the center of the circle stand one or two musammi'in. These are the singers who sing mystic poems to the glory of God and to the praise of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Inside every breast, with the rhythm getting faster and faster, the name Allah becomes Allah. Allah. Then ha. Ha. Then as if you are out of breath. And it comes no longer from the lips, but it comes from the throat. It is this breath of the heart that wafts while the bodies sway up and down with the feet stuck to the ground. The huge, unanimous rail sounds like the vibration of a giant saw. The eyes are still closed. The face is light and an expression which draws both on pain and on joy. This is what Hadra is. And in this one, it's almost like in one sentence. Yeah. I have seen Sheikh Sidi Khalid going like this. It's almost like directing the whole thing. Because it has to be that way. Mm. It's a discipline. It cannot be any other way. An orchestra.
Uh-huh. I know that within Sufism, women and men have always been respected as equals on the spiritual path. So I'm wondering, when it comes to all these spiritual practices that we have talked about, from dhikr, sama', hadra, are they like performed the same way by both men and women? Or there is some kind of difference?
During the pandemic, actually, we used to meet for two hours, and would perform sama', and then sama' was, performed from different parts of the world, and then since people did not or could not meet, it was performed, from different houses. But now people meet on Zoom and sama' is performed in different zawiyas. And you see men on one side and women face to face. You see a man singing or chanting a poem, and you see on the other side a woman who takes over. So there's no difference. And I might have mentioned that, women, actually in Sufism, can lead prayer. And I have seen Sidna Sheikh pray behind a woman. And one of the things he said, it wouldn't surprise me that the next person to take over tariqah would be a sheikha, or not a sheikh. Would be a woman, another man. It wouldn't surprise me, he said. This is how he esteems the presence of women in society. So there is no difference. The position of the woman in the society, in the eyes of Sufism, she is as capable as man.
Uh-huh. From my research and experience, I know that Sufism has an ability to evolve and to adapt the religion to the local culture, which could be why it is criticized by some Muslims. So I was wondering, how do you counteract the attitude that some Muslims may hold, that Sufis aren't like real Muslims, or that Sufism is not true and is heretical?
I have found a lot of people, Actually, you know, when I perform prayer like them, when I do my zakat or my psalm, they see me as a normal person, and that's it. And then when I start talking about the Quran, when I start reading it, or sometimes we, you know, get into a conversation, is everything. I mean, it's the same. There is no difference. But the moment I start, you know, looking at things in a different manner, and I mention Sufism, the moment the word Sufism is heard, then there is a veil. A veil drops by, and that's it. People don't want to hear. Because Sufis, for example, according to a lot of Muslims, is atheism. In their understanding, Sufis associate themselves with God. They associate themselves with the presence of God. There are a lot of, you know, poets and people of God who actually dared describe their station, because they were not able to hold it. Al-Hallaj, for example, said, "Ma'budukum tahta qadami wa ana Allah." Anyone hearing this, the one you adore, is under my shoe, and I am God. It translates into that, but the actual translation is "Ma'budukum antum tahta qadami." Your Lord, or the one you worship, is under my foot. And the one I worship is God. When they killed him, they found a dinar under his shoe. So in other words, they worship material good. But because a person does not have this relation with, or does not look at things with a different eye, you're just stuck. You can't. And of course, you're pinpointed. It doesn't matter what you tell people now. It doesn't matter, you know, that they see Sheikh Khalid bin Tunis at the United Nations, or that they see that, look at what's happening to Tariq al-Alawiya, you know, in Europe, in the entire world, with planes and with computers and everything. And still, because it is called Sufi path, and because there are people who are called Sheikh and things like that, then it is always going to remain a little bit, you know, there's people are not going to like it.
Uh-huh. All right, Mr. Khalid, before we wrap up, I have one final question. We could say that the best way to avoid misconceptions about any topic in general, not just Sufism, is by educating yourself about it. So, I guess my final question is, where would the non-Sufi go to learn more about the Sufi practices and beliefs?
If you think that you're going to learn about Sufism or the discipline in Sufism in the books, and you may learn about the schools of Sufism and things like that. You may have definitions, just like the definition I give you at the beginning. But Sufism is an experience. That's why Sheikh Sidi Khalid, in his books, always talks about personal experiences. There is Sufism and there is the history of Sufism. I tell my children, if you want to learn a language, you learn the language. You don't learn about the language. You will learn about the language when you have the language. You can learn about Sufism. That's one thing. Go to the libraries, you know. But if you want to be a Sufi, just be yourself.
That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you so much, Mr. Khalid Al-Abdi, for joining me in this beneficial and informative discussion about the spiritual experience of being a Sufi.
Very pleased.
If you're hearing this message, that means you have listened to the entire episode. And for that, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. This podcast has been brought to you by religion majors from the class of 2022 at Emory University. Thank you again for listening.